We returned as we had come, but rode with greater speed, for the horses now were eager, and eventually came down from the hills and saw the flat plain, and in the distance at the ocean's edge the settlement and the great hall of Hrothgar. Now Bulliwith veered away and led us in another direction, toward high rocky crags swept by the ocean winds. I rode alongside Hergar and inquired the reason for this, and he said we were to seek out the dwarves of the region. At this I was much surprised, for the men of the north have no dwarves among their society. They are never seen in the streets, nor do any sit at the feet of kings, nor are any to be found counting money, or keeping records, or any of the things we know of dwarves.
In the Mediterranean, from Egyptian times, dwarves were thought to be especially intelligent and trustworthy, and tasks such as bookkeeping and money handling were reserved for them.
Now we came to a region of caves, hollowed and windswept, and Bulliwith dismounted from his horse, and all the warriors of Bulliwith did likewise, and proceeded by foot. I heard a hissing sound, and verily I saw puffs of steam issue from one and another of these several caves. We entered one cave, and there found dwarves. They were in appearance thus, of the ordinary size of dwarf, but distinguished by hands of great size, and bearing features that appeared exceedingly aged. Each dwarf wore a garment of fur or sable. Each also wore a thin belt of hide decorated with bits of hammered gold. The dwarves greeted our arrival politely, with no sign of fear. Hergar said these creatures have magic powers, and need fear no man on earth. Hergar said this also, that the appearance of great age among the dwarves was a true thing, and that a dwarf lived beyond the span of any ordinary man. Now I saw that the hissing and steam issued from great cauldrons, into which hammered steel blades were plunged to temper the metal, for the dwarves make weapons that are highly prized by the Northmen. Indeed, I saw the warriors of Bulliwith looking about the caves eagerly, as any woman in a bazaar shop selling precious silks. Bulliwith made inquiries, and was directed to the topmost of the caves, wherein sat a single dwarf, older than all the others, with a beard and hair of purest white, and a creased and wrinkled face. This dwarf was called Tengol, which means a judge of good and evil, and also a soothsayer. This Tengol must have had the magical powers that all said he did, for he immediately greeted Bulliwith by his name, bid him sit with him, and we gathered a short distance away, standing. The Tengol spoke in a high voice as a child, and Hergar told me the meaning was thus.
Oh, Bulliwith, you are a great warrior, but you have met your match in the monsters of the mist, the eaters of the dead. This shall be a struggle to the death, and you shall need all your strength and wisdom to overcome the challenge. To kill the Wendel, you must strike at the head and the heart. You must overcome their very mother in the Thunder Caves.
I did not understand the meaning of these words.
You know of this, for it had always been true through all the ages of man. Shall your brave warriors die one by one? Or shall you strike at the mother in the caves? Here is no prophecy, only the choice of a man or a hero.
Now Bulliwith made some response, but it was low, and lost to me in the howl of the wind that raked the entrance to the cave. Whatever the words, the dwarf spoke further.
That is the hero's answer, Bulliwith. And I would expect none other from you. Thus shall I help your quest.
Then a number of his kind came forward into the light from the dark recesses of the cave, and they bore many objects.
Here, said the Tengol, are lengths of rope made from the skins of seals caught at the first melting of the ice. These ropes will help you attain the ocean entrance to the Thunder Caves.
I thank you.
Bulliwif said.
And here also,
the Tengol said,
are 7 daggers forged with steam and magic for you and your warriors. Great swords will be of no avail in the Thunder Caves. Carry these new weapons bravely, and you shall accomplish all you desire.
Bulliwif took the daggers and thanked the dwarf. He stood.
When shall we do this thing?
He asked.
Yesterday is better than today,
the Tengol replied.
So make haste, and carry out your intentions with a firm heart and a strong arm.
And what follows if we succeed?
Bulliwif asked.
Then the Wendel shall be mortally wounded and thrash in its death throes of final time, and after this last agony, the land shall have peace and sunlight forevermore, and your name shall be sung glorious in all the halls of the Northlands forevermore.
The deeds of dead men are so sung,
Bulliwif said.
That is true,
the dwarf said, and laughed.
And also the deeds of heroes who live, but never are sung the deeds of ordinary men. All this you know.
Now Bulliwif departed from the cave, and gave to each of us the dagger of the dwarves, and we descended from the rocky windswept crags, and returned to the kingdom, and the great hall of Hrothgar as night was falling. All these things took place, and I saw them with my own eyes. No mist came that night. In the great hall of Hrothgar, a mighty feast was held, and Bulliwif and all his warriors joined in great celebration. Bulliwif himself ravished 6 slave girls, and perhaps more, but despite merrymaking, neither he nor his warriors were truly cheerful. Now I joined in the general revelry, for I felt as one of them, having spent much time in their company, or so it seemed. Indeed, that night I felt I had been born a Northman. Hergar, much intoxicated, told me freely of the mother of the Wendel. He said this,
"The mother of the Wendel is very old, and she lives in the Caves of Thunder. These Thunder Caves have 2 openings, one from the land and another from the sea. But the entrance from the land is guarded by the Wendel, who protect their old mother. Therefore we shall attack from the sea."
I inquired of him, "What is the nature of this mother of the Wendel?" Hergar said that no Northman knew this thing, but that it was said among them that she was old, older than the old crones they call the Angel of Death, and also that she was frightful to look upon, and also, too, that she was strong beyond all accounting. And he said at the last that the Wendel called upon her to direct them in all their affairs of life. Then Hergar turned from me and slept. Now this event occurred. In the depths of the night, as the celebrations were drawing to a close, and the warriors were drifting into sleep, Bulliwif sought me out. He sat beside me and drank mead from a horned cup, and he spoke slowly in the north tongue, so that I should understand his meaning. He said first to me,
"Did you comprehend the words of the dwarf Tengol?"
I replied that I did, with the help of Hergar.
"Then you know I shall die."
I did not know any reply or response to make, but finally said to him, in the north fashion, "Believe no prophecy until it bears fruit." Bulliwif said,
"You have seen much of our ways. Tell me what is true. Do you draw sounds?"
I answered that I did.
"Then look to your safety, and do not be overbrave. You dress, and now you speak as a Northman, and not a foreign man. See that you live."
I placed my hand upon his shoulder, as I had seen his fellow warriors do to him in greeting. He smiled then.
I fear no thing, he said, and need no comfort. I tell you to look to your own safety, for your own account. Now it is wisest to sleep.
So speaking, he turned away from me, and devoted his attention to a slave girl, whom he pleasured not a dozen paces from where I sat, and I turned away, hearing the moans and laughter of this woman, and at length I fell into a sleep. Before the first pink streaks of dawn lighted the sky, Bullywiff and his warriors, myself among them, rode out from the kingdom of Hrothgar and followed the cliff edge above the sea. On this day I did not feel fit, for my head ached. Also was my stomach sour from the celebration of the previous night. Surely all the warriors of Bullywiff were in like condition, yet no man gave signal of these discomforts. Hergr carried upon his horse the sealskin ropes of the dwarfs, and I rode up to travel alongside him. I inquired what was our purpose on this day. Hergr said to me,
"On this morning we attack the mother of the Wendol in the Thunder Caves. This we shall do by attacking from the sea, as I have told you yesterday."
While I rode, I looked from my horse down at the sea, which smashed upon the rock cliffs. "Do we attack by boat?"
"No,"
Hergr said, and slapped his hand upon the sealskin ropes. Then I took his meaning to be that we should climb down the cliffs on the ropes, and thereby in some fashion make an entrance into the caves. I was much frightened at this prospect, for never have I liked to be exposed upon the high places. I said as much. Hergr said to me,
"Be thankful. If you have the fear of high places, then this day you shall overcome it, and so you shall have faced a great challenge, and so you shall be adjudged a hero."
I said to him, "I do not want to be a hero." At this he laughed, and said that I expressed such an opinion only because I was an Arab. Then also he said that I had a stiff head, by which the Northman means the aftermath of drinking. This was true, as I have already told. Also, I was in ill temper. To Hergr I said, "You and Bullywiff and all your company may be heroes as suits your temper, but I have no part in this affair, not number as one of you." At this speech Hergr laughed. Then he called to Bullywiff and spoke a rapid speech. Bullywiff answered him back, over his shoulder. Then Hergr spoke to me.
"Bullywiff says that you will do as we do."
"I cannot do this thing. If you force me to do it, I shall surely die."
"How shall you die?"
"I shall lose my grip on the ropes." This answer made Hergr laugh heartily yet again, and he repeated my words to all the Northmen, and they all laughed at what I had said. Then Bullywiff spoke a few words. Hergr said to me,
"Bullywiff says that you shall lose your grip only if you release the ropes from your hands, and only a fool would do such a thing. Bullywiff says you are an Arab, but no fool."
Now, here is a true aspect of the nature of men, that in his fashion Bullywiff said that I could climb the ropes, and for his speech I believed it as much as he, and was cheered in my heart to a slight degree. This Hergr saw as he spoke these words.
"Each person bears a fear which is special to him. One man fears a close space, and another fears drowning. Each laughs at the other and calls him stupid. Thus fear is only preference, to be counted the same as the preference for one woman or another, or mutton for pig, or cabbage for onion. We say fear is fear."
Now Hergr laughed at my face, and spoke these words,
"Praise Allah, for he put death at the end of life, and not at the beginning."
Curtly I said in reply that I saw no benefit in hastening the end.
"Indeed, no man does,"
Hergr responded to me, and then he said,
"Look to Bullywiff. See how he sits straight. See how he rides forward, though he knows he shall soon die.
I answered, I do not know he shall die.
Yes, Hergr said, but Bulliwif knows.
Now well I know that these Northmen are brave to a fault, but as I looked at the precipice of the cliff below us, my heart twisted over inside my chest, and I thought I should be purging myself at any instant. Verily, the cliff was absolutely sheer, lacking the least grip for hand or feet, and it descended for the distance of perhaps 400 paces. Verily, the crashing waves were so far beneath us that they appeared as miniature waves, tiny as the most delicate drawing of an artist. To me, the climbing down of these cliffs was madness beyond the madness of a foaming dog, but the Northmen proceeded in normal fashion. Bulliwif directed the pounding of the stout wooden stakes into the earth. Around these, the sealskin ropes were bound, and the trailing ends flung over the sides of the cliffs. Then Bulliwif spoke to his gathering.
First I shall proceed, so that when I reach the bottom, all shall know that the ropes are stout and the journey can be accomplished. I await you at the bottom, on the narrow ledge you see below.
I looked to this narrow ledge. To call it narrow is to call a camel kind. It was, in truth, the barest strip of flat rock, continually washed and pounded by the surf.
When all have reached the bottom,
Bulliwif said,
we can attack the mother of the Wendol in the Thunder Caves.
Now here is the manner of his descent. A sling is placed around the waist of the descending man, and all his fellows strain to lower him down the cliff. Meanwhile, this same man grips for support onto the second rope, which dangles on the cliff face. Further, the descending man carries a stout staff of oaken wood, fitted at one end with a leather thong, or strap, about his wrist. This staff he employs for a prod to push himself hither and yon as he moves down the rocky surface. As Bulliwif went down, becoming ever smaller to my eyes, I saw that he maneuvered with the sling, the rope, and the stick very agilely. But I was not deceived into thinking this some trivial matter, for I saw it to be difficult and requiring practice. At length he safely reached the bottom and stood on the narrow ledge with the surf crashing over him. In truth, he was so diminished we could hardly see him wave his hand in signal that he was safe. Now the sling was hauled up, and also with it the oaken staff. Hergr turned to me, speaking,
you shall go next.
I said that I was feeling poorly. Also, I said I wished to see another man descend, in order better to study the manner of the descent. Hergr said,
it is more difficult with each descent, because there are fewer here above to lower a man down. The last man must descend without the sling at all, and that shall be Ekthgau, for his arms are iron. It is a mark of our favor which allows you to be the second man to descend. Go now.
I saw in his eyes that there was no hope of delay, and so I was myself fitted into the sling, and I gripped the stout staff in my hands, which were slippery with sweat, and my whole body likewise was slippery with sweat, and I shivered in the wind as I went over the side of the cliff, and for the last time saw the 5 Northmen straining at the rope, and then they were lost from view. I made my descent. In truth, I remember little from all that transpired, only this. In due time, which in truth seemed as the whole duration of my life and more, I reached the bottom, and Bulliwif clapped me on the shoulder and said I had done well. Now I sought to hold my balance upon the slippery ledge, and this so occupied my attention, I did not watch the others coming down the cliff. My only desire was this, to keep from being swept away into the sea. Verily I saw with my own eyes that the waves were taller than 3 men. Many times I was knocked from my feet by these waves. I was drenched over my whole body,
and shivering so badly that I could not speak words for the clacking of my teeth. Now all the warriors of Bulliwif made their descent, and all were safe. Then Bulliwif spoke,
"We shall descend into the water and swim into the cave. I shall be first."
These words of new madness came upon me at a time when I could endure nothing further. To my eyes, the plan of Bulliwif was folly beyond folly. I saw the waves crash in, bursting upon jagged rocks. I saw the waves pull away again with the tug of a giant's strength, only to recover their power and crash forward anew. Verily, I watched and I believed that no man could swim in that water, but rather he would be dashed to bony splinters in an instant. But I made no protest, for I was past any comprehension. Bulliwif watched the movement of the waves, choosing his time, and then he leapt into the surf. I hesitated, and someone, I have always believed it to be Hergar, pushed me. I fell deep in the swirling sea of numbing coldness. Then I perceived Bulliwif kicking down in the depths of the sea, and I followed after him, and he swam into a kind of passage in the rocks. In all things I did as he. Now it is true that my lungs burned as if a fire, and I knew in my heart that I could not continue much longer in this icy sea. Then the surge ran forward, and I was flung headlong, knocked here and there, and then suddenly I was up and breathing air. I gasped, and all the warriors of Bulliwif set their heads above the surface and gasped likewise. Now, here is what I saw. We were in a kind of pond or lake, inside a cave, with a smooth, rocky dome and a seaward entrance through which we had just traversed. Directly ahead was a flat, rocky space. I saw three or four dark shapes squatted about a fire. These creatures chanted in high voices. Now also I understood why this was called the Cave of Thunder, for with each crash of the surf, the sound in the cave reverberated with such power that the ears ached and the very air seemed to shake and press. In this place, this cave, Bulliwif and his warriors made their attack, and I joined in with them, and with our short daggers we killed the four demons in the I saw them clearly for the first time in the flickering light of the fire. They were short creatures, and broad, and squat, and hairy on all parts of their bodies, save their palms, the soles of their feet, and their faces. Their faces were very large, with mouth and jaws large and prominent, and of an ugly aspect. Also their heads were larger than the heads of normal men. Their eyes were sunk deep in their heads. The brows were large, and not by virtue of hairy brows, but of bone. Also their teeth were large and sharp. One of the creatures was slow to die, and with its tongue formed some sounds which had to my ear a quality of speech, but I cannot know if this was so, and I tell it again with no conviction of the matter. Then we heard a ghostly echoing chant, a sound rising and falling in time to the thunder pounding of the surf, and this sound came from the recesses of the cave. Bulliwif led us into the depths. There we came upon three of the creatures, prostrate upon the ground, faces pressed to the earth, and their hands raised in supplication to an old creature lurking in the shadow. These suppliants were chanting, and did not perceive our arrival. But the creature saw us, and screamed hideously at our approach. This creature I took to be the mother of the Wendol, but if she was a female, I saw no sign, for she was old to the point of being sexless. Bulliwif alone fell upon the suppliants and killed them all, while the mother creature moved back into the shadows and screamed horribly. I could not see her well, but this much is true, that she was surrounded by serpents, which coiled at her feet and upon her hands and around her neck. These serpents hissed and flicked their tongues, and as they were all about her, upon her body and also on the ground, none of the warriors dared make an approach. Then Bulliwif attacked her, and she gave a fearful scream as he plunged his dagger deep into her breast, for he was heedless of the snakes. Many times he struck the mother of the Wendel with his dagger. Never did this woman collapse, but always did she stand, though the blood poured from her as if from a fountain, and from the several wounds Bulliwif inflicted upon her, and all the time she screamed a most frightful sound. Then at last she toppled and lay dead, and Bulliwif turned to face his warriors. Now we saw that this woman, the mother of the eaters of the dead, had wounded him. A silver pin, such as a pin for hair, was buried in his stomach. This same pin trembled with each heartbeat. Bulliwif plucked it forth, and there was a gush of blood. Yet he did not sink to his knees, mortally wounded, but rather he stood and gave the order to leave the cave. This we did by the second and landward entrance. This entrance had been guarded, but all the Wendel guards had fled before the screams of their dying mother. We departed without harassment. Bulliwif led us from the caves and back to our horses, and then did he collapse on the ground. Ekthgau, with a face of sadness most uncommon among the Northmen, directed the fashioning of a stretcher, and with this we carried Bulliwif back across the fields to the kingdom of Hrothgar. Now we came to the kingdom of Hrothgar, where we were greeted with cheers and happiness, and no sadness, although Bulliwif was direly injured. A bowl of onion broth was brought for him, and he refused it, saying,
"I have the soup illness. Do not trouble yourselves on my account."
Then he called for a celebration, and insisted that he preside over it, and he drank mead, and he was merry. I was near to him when he said to King Hrothgar in the midst of the festivities,
"I have no slaves." "All of my slaves are your slaves," Hrothgar said.
Then Bulliwif said,
"I have no horses." "All of my horses are yours,"
Hrothgar answered.
"Think no more on these matters."
And Bulliwif, his wounds bound, was happy, and he smiled. And although I would not have thought it possible, he ravished a slave girl, and afterward he said to me as a joke,
"A dead man is no use to anyone."
And then Bulliwif fell into a sleep, and his color became more pale, and his breathing more shallow. I feared he should never wake from this sleep. So also I fell into a sleep. Hergar awakened me with these words,
"The Wendel come. They know of the mortal wounds of Bulliwif, and they seek a final revenge for the killing of their mother."
Each of the warriors of Bulliwif, myself among them, took a place at the perimeter of the fortifications that we had drawn up against the Wendel. These defenses were poor, yet we had none else. We peered into the mists to glimpse the horsemen galloping down upon us. I expected great fear, but I did not feel this, for I had seen the aspect of the Wendel, and I knew them to be creatures, if not men, then like enough to men as monkeys are also like men. But I knew them to be mortal, and they could die. Thus I had no fear, save the expectation of this final battle. In this manner was I alone, for I saw that the warriors of Bulliwif displayed much fear. Verily, as we had killed the mother of the Wendel, who was their leader, so also had we lost Bulliwif, who was our own leader. And then I heard a commotion behind me, and upon my turning, I saw this: Bulliwif, pale as the mist itself, garbed in white and bound in his wounds, stood erect upon the land of the kingdom of Hrothgar, and on his shoulders sat two black ravens, one to each side. And at this sight the Northmen screamed of his coming, and they raised their weapons into the air and howled for the battle. Now the ravens flew off, and Bulliwif gripped his sword Runding, and met the attack. No words can describe the final attack of the Wendel in the dawn of the mist. No words will say what blood was spilled, what screams filled the thick air, what horses and horsemen died in hideous agony. With my own eyes, I saw Ecgtheow with his arms of steel. Verily, his head was lopped off by a Wendel sword. I myself killed 3 of the Wendel, and suffered a spear in the shoulder, which pain was like a plunge into fire. I thought I should collapse, and yet I fought on. Now the sun burst through the mist, and the dawn was full upon us, and the mist slipped away, and the horsemen disappeared. In the broad light of day, I saw bodies everywhere, including many bodies of the Wendel, for they had not collected their dead. This truly was the sign of their end, for they were in disarray and could not again attack Hrothgar, and all the people of the kingdom of Hrothgar knew this meaning and rejoiced. Hugr bathed my wound and was elated, until they carried the body of Bulliwif into the great hall of Hrothgar. Bulliwif was dead a score over. His body was hacked by the blades of 12 adversaries. Hugr saw this sight and burst into tears, and turned his face from me. But there was no need, for I myself felt tears that misted my sight. Now of the party of Bulliwif, once the number 13, only 4 remained. I among them, we set out Bulliwif beneath a wooden roof, and left his body with a cup of mead in his hands. Then Hugr said to the assembled people, "Who shall die with this noble man?" And a woman, a slave of King Hrothgar, said she would die with Bulliwif. The usual preparations of the Northmen were then made.
Although Ibn Fadlan doesn't specify any passage of time, several days probably elapsed before the funeral ceremony occurred.
Now a ship was fitted out upon the shore below the hall of Hrothgar, and treasures of gold and silver were laid upon it, and the carcasses of 2 horses also. Then the slave girl was taken to each of the warriors of Bulliwif, and to me also, and I had carnal knowledge of her, and she said to me, "My master thanks you." Her countenance and manner were most joyful. This was the nature of the thing. So then I said this, "Tell your master when you see him that I have lived to write." These words I do not know if she comprehended. I said to her, "It was the wish of your master." "Then I will tell him," she said, and most cheerfully proceeded to the next warrior of Bulliwif. Now in the evening, as the sun was making its descent into the sea, the ship of Bulliwif was prepared upon the beach, and the maiden was taken into the tent of the ship, and the old crone, who is called the Angel of Death, placed the dagger between her ribs, and I and Hugr held the cord that strangled her, and we seated her alongside Bulliwif, and then we departed. All of this day I had taken no food or drink, for I knew I must participate in these affairs, and I had no wish to suffer the embarrassment of purging myself. But I felt no revulsion at any of the deeds of that day, nor was I faint or light of head. For this I was proud in secret. Also, it is true that at the moment of her death the maiden smiled, and this expression afterward remained, so that she sat next to her master with this same smile upon her pale face. Now the ship of Bulliwif was set aflame, and pushed out into the sea, and the Northmen stood upon the rocky shore and made many invocations to their gods. With my own eyes I saw the ship carried by the currents as a burning pyre, and then it was lost to vision, and the darkness of night descended upon the Northlands. Now I passed some further weeks in the company of the warriors and nobles of the kingdom of Hrothgar. This was a pleasant time, for the people were gracious and hospitable, and most attentive to my wounds, which healed well, praise Allah. But it happened soon enough that I desire to return to my own land. To King Hrothgar I made known I was the emissary of the Caliph of Baghdad, and that I must complete the business he had sent me upon, or incur his wrath. None of this mattered to Hrothgar, who said I was a noble warrior, that he desired I should remain in his lands, to live the life of such an honored warrior. Now I went to Hergar, speaking of my plight, and Hergar said he would arrange for my departure with the king. Here was the manner of it. Hergar sought the audience of King Hrothgar in private, and said to him that of the 5 sons of the king, only one survived, and he was Wulfgar, who had gone to Bulliwith as messenger, and now remained far off. Hergar said that Wulfgar should be summoned home, and that a party for this purpose be arranged, for there was no other heir save Wulfgar. Then it happened at an evening banquet that Hrothgar called for the fitting out of a ship and a crew, for a voyage to return Wulfgar to his kingdom. I requested to join the crew, and this the old king could not deny me. The preparation of the ship took the space of several days. I spent much time with Hergar in this interval. Hergar had chosen to remain behind. In truth, it was a sad leave-taking, and I was heavy-hearted to depart from Hergar and the remainder of the warriors. Hergar felt this also. I gripped his shoulder, and he mine, and then I set out upon the black ship, which carried me to the land of the Danes. As this ship, with her stout crew, slipped away from the shores of Venden, I had view of the gleaming rooftops of the great hall of Heorot, and turning away, of the grey and vast ocean before us. Now it happened.
The manuscript ends abruptly at this point, and although there is clearly more, further passages have never been discovered. This is, of course, the purest historical accident, but every translator has commented on the odd appropriateness of this abrupt ending, which suggests the start of some new adventure, some strange new sight, that for the most arbitrary of reasons of the past 1,000 years, will be denied to us. Ibn Fadlan's description of the mist monsters suggests Neanderthal anatomy, and raises the question whether the Neanderthal did, in fact, disappear from the earth thousands of years ago, or whether these early men persisted into historic times. Arguments based on analogies cut both ways. There are historical examples of a handful of other people with technologically superior culture wiping out a more primitive society in a matter of years. That's largely the story of European contact with the New World. But there are also examples of primitive societies existing in isolated areas, unknown to more advanced, civilized peoples nearby. Such a tribe was recently discovered in the Philippines. I should probably tell you something about how I came to write this novel. Eaters of the Dead was originally conceived on a dare. In 1974, my friend Kurt Villidson said he wanted to teach a college course that he would call the Great Bores. This course would include all the texts that were supposedly crucial to Western civilization, but which were, in fact, no longer read willingly by anyone because they were so tedious. Kurt said that the first of the Great Bores that he would address was the epic poem Beowulf. I disagreed. I said that Beowulf was a dramatic, exciting story, and I said I could prove it. I went home and immediately began making notes for this novel. What sort of narrative would be most desirable? I concluded the most useful account would be written by an outsider, someone not part of the culture, who could report objectively on the events as they occurred. On reflection, I realized I already knew of such a person. Back in the 10th century, an Arab named Ibn Fadlan had traveled from Baghdad into what is now Russia, where he came in contact with the Vikings. His manuscript, which is well known to scholars, provides one of the earliest eyewitness accounts of Viking life and culture. But for me as a novelist, he had several advantages. First, his style was imitable. Second, he was believable. And third, he was unexpected. And after 1,000 years, I felt that Ibn Fadlan would not mind being revived in a new role, as an eyewitness to the events that led to the epic poem of Beowulf. I obtained the existing manuscript fragments and combined them, with only slight modifications, into the beginning of Eaters of the Dead. I then wrote the rest of the novel in the style of the manuscript to carry Ibn Fadlan on the rest of his now fictional journey. While I was writing, I felt that I was drawing the line between fact and fiction very clearly. For example, one of my cited translators, Per Fraus Dulles, means literally in Latin, by trickery, deceit. But within a few years, I could no longer be certain which passages were real and which I had made up. I mention this because the tendency to blur the boundaries of fact and fiction has become widespread in modern society. Fiction is now seamlessly inserted into everything from scholarly histories to television news. Of course, television is understood to be venal, its transgressions shrugged off by most of us. But the attitude of postmodern scholars represents a more fundamental challenge. Some in academic life now argue seriously that there's no difference between fact and fiction, that all ways of reading text are arbitrary and personal, and that therefore pure invention is just as valid as hard research. At best, I think this attitude evades traditional scholarly discipline. At worst, it can be nasty and dangerous. But such academic views were not prevalent 20 years ago when I sat down to write this novel in the guise of a scholarly monograph. When Eaters of the Dead was first published, this playful version of Beowulf received a rather irritable reception from many reviewers, as if I had desecrated a monument. But Beowulf scholars all seem to enjoy it, and many have written to say so.
Among the many other titles by Michael Crichton available on audio from Random House are Airframe, read by Blair Brown, The Lost World, read by Anthony Heald, Jurassic Park, read by John Hurd, Sphere, read by Edward Asner, and Disclosure, read by John Lithgow. This has been a Random House Audiobooks presentation.